Hello, and thank you for joining us for the Privacy Webinar. I'm Sarah Bamford with Realcom, and in today's session we have an excellent lineup of industry thought leaders as panelists. Before we get started, I just want to go over a few housekeeping items. Please use the Q&A box on the bottom left of your screen to submit your questions or comments, and we will try to get to all the questions during the session. If we don't get back to you on any of the questions that you sent in, we will do our best to follow up with you once the event is concluded. For the best webinar experience, we recommend either logging in from a desktop or a laptop. And due to the unprecedented usage of Adobe Connect, we recommend that you pause any other internet applications or streaming services that are running concurrently. We will also be sending out a copy of the webinar recording, and in the event you are experiencing any technical issues, please contact me at sbamperet@vilcom.com. This education is supported by our gold sponsors, Cohn Resnick, Cooper Lighting Solutions, and Join, and we will learn more about these companies throughout the session. And with that, I'd like to introduce the moderator for today's event, Jim Young. Jim is founder and CEO of Vilcom. He has over 20 years of experience in real estate and technology. Jim has been involved in some of the most important projects in commercial real estate. So thank you very much for moderating, Jim, and I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Sarah, and thank you for the great job you do in moderating all of our webinars. Well, before we get started, I would just like to, take a note of what we're all going through, unprecedented times. Really appreciate the fact that you've taken the time to sit on this webinar. As much as we have to deal with the crisis that we're all dealing with, business some way somehow has to go on. And so we're trying to, you know, put content and issues and topics out there that are relevant to the COVID-19 coronavirus crisis we're all going through, but also others that, you know, will move us back into a normal business time frame whenever this is behind us. Interestingly enough, today's topic does actually tie in with what we're going through. And I don't know if you've noticed, and I'll get into a second, but the privacy issues, the cybersecurity issues are becoming much more noticeable and prevalent in this time. And unfortunately, there are bad folks out there who take full advantage of situations like this. So at this point, I would like to say a special thank you to all of our speakers, who I will introduce in a bit, but all of these folks are dealing with the crisis in their own ways and yet have found the time to be able to be with us here today. And once you hear this webinar and you hear what these folks have to offer, I think you're going to realize that these are probably some of the most up-to-speed experienced professionals on the topic of privacy as it relates to technology in general, as well as technology in our buildings. And the topic today is, you know, defining privacy in highly connected buildings, you know, safety, efficiency, or surveillance. And I think that if you think about where the building world's going, or the built world's going with smart, connected, high-performance buildings, sensors everywhere, microphones everywhere, cameras everywhere, the opportunity for privacy breaches is very high. And so I think it's a very timely conversation. And as we all have been forced to go home, I think you're going to see throughout the conversation that some of the technology exposure we have with the entire world now moving to a mobile workforce capacity, that the issues are serious. So I'm just going to take you through a couple slides to get started. Then each of our speakers is going to have a few minutes to offer their point of view. We're going to go into a conversation. And I really hope the audience stays engaged, ask us questions. If you've got ideas for polls that you'd like to have brought up, Sarah's very good at putting polls together in a short amount of time. So this is only as good as you engage us. And I know we're on a webinar platform and not in a room together, but we still can get your feedback and bring it into the conversation. So just to kind of give you a really light, high overview, CCPA and GDPR, I'm not sure if you are aware of this, but these are two privacy acts that started GDPR first in Europe, and then the California Consumer Privacy Act, kind of taking the lead in the United States, and many feeling that it will be the foundation for serious privacy issues that we have coming up in the U.S. Now, interestingly, juxtaposed against CCPA and GDPR is you have the East, notably China, where privacy is not an issue. There is none. And so throughout this conversation, we're going to talk about, especially if you have a real estate portfolio that spans the globe, privacy is looked upon differently in different parts of the world. And as real estate owners and operators, of which people spend most of their time inside buildings, this issue is going to continue to grow day by day. All right, let me just get to our next slide. We're not going to go into great detail in this webinar, but I would really encourage each and every one of you to start to understand some of the little different fundamental differences between GDPR and CCPA. In this particular document, which Sarah will make available in the chat box, it talks about scope, personal data information, high-risk assessment, data protection, right to erasure, deletion. At what point does somebody have to delete your privacy information? Right to access. Do I have the ability? And I know some of our panelists, especially the ones in California, have had to, make the data accessible to their customers. What does that look like? And then portability requirement. Restriction of processing, right to opt out. If I walk into a mall, if I walk into an office building, do I have any rights of opting out of any data that is collected by me? So you can start to see some of the differences, but this is a nice document that actually gives you the opportunity to compare them side by side. All right, I think we have a quick poll on Zoom bombing, Sarah, didn't we? Before I go into the Zoom bombing section, which is literally a new word added to our language within the last couple weeks, I'd like to just get a quick poll on people who are you aware of Zoom bombing or not? Looks like we got about 70-80% do. It's been in the news quite a bit. For those of you who don't, I'm going to give you a quick update. But it just goes to show you how fast something like this can take place, especially in a situation like we're in right now. We were just told this morning that Zoom bombing ZDNet had an article that Zoom was going to be restricting all of their new features until the cybersecurity and the privacy issues could be looked at. So let me take you through a quick. Zoom bombing is when somebody actually comes into a Zoom meeting that was not invited and either does something, show something pornographic or hateful, and I actually has happened at my daughter's university, so I know firsthand what it's all about. And basically, on the stock market, was very quick to respond to this. Zoom stocks went up because everybody's using Zoom. They went down when they found out that there was a potential for breach. Then New York Attorney General started to look into their privacy practices. When you hit record, who owns that data? How much access can Zoom get to that information? There was another article today or yesterday that said Zoom was selling data to Facebook without Facebook or without Zoom people's permission. And then this particular individual, very technical, shows that he felt that Zoom is actually not looking like a regular installed program. It actually behaved more like malware. I will leave it all up to you to get to the bottom of this. These are just some examples of what happened literally in the last 7, 10, maybe 14 days. Bad guys taking advantage of situations, people working out of their homes and privacy. Another way we're seeing, cell phone data map reveals which Americans are ignoring quarantine. I'm amazed at how they showed people from Florida. Where did they go after they left spring break? There's now a site up there that literally shows which parts of the country are staying at home the best by virtue of non-movement of cell phone data. This was an organization out of Europe that was doing this. My question is, how did they get that data? Did our cell phone providers provide it? Is there benefit to it? You bet, but there's also privacy issues associated with it. And then this is the exact opposite in their coronavirus fight. China, and you can see why they did it. China gives citizens a color code, basically, based upon an analytics of your data, where you've been, who you've been close to, some self-required testing. They issue you a code, yellow, green, red, and when you go to public places, you have to show this code in order to get in, do your business, or whatever. So if you're red, you go out on the streets, and everybody's getting used to having to show their code. In some cases, I can see why this is good from a health pandemic situation, but again, from a privacy standpoint, it's a slippery slope, and that's what we're going to talk about today. All right, so with that, I would like to introduce our first speaker. Macerich is a company we've been, has been part of the RealComp community for over 20 years. Brian, just a great supporter. Brian, VP of IT at Macerich, is responsible for smart building infrastructure at over 50 centers portfolio-wide. He oversees the installation and support for CCTV, Wi-Fi, energy management, shopper counting, DAS. Brian supports digital marketing initiatives, including digital signage and property websites. So in other words, if you're in a Macerich mall and you look up on the ceiling or on the wall and there's some technology, Brian is the guy responsible for it. So Brian, thank you so much for joining us today, and we're looking forward to your comments.
Thanks, Jim. So to get started, well, that's a good point, Jim. People say, when I walk in the mall with a lot of my constituents at Macerich, they say, nobody looks at the ceiling. And the first thing I do when I walk in the mall is I look up at the ceiling. And they're like, you're ruining my perception. I'm like, yeah, but I'm an IT, and it's different. So thanks for the intro. Welcome to everyone. Thank you for joining. I apologize if you hear maybe a daughter singing Frozen at the top of her lungs in the background, as we are all quarantined. As Jim said yesterday, it's kind of become the norm and something to expect. So with that, I'll jump into who we are as Macerich. We own and manage shopping malls across the U.S., as Jim mentioned. We have about 47 to 50 regional, 47 regional shopping centers with about 51 million square feet of GLA. We like to think of ourselves as more of a town center than just a shopping mall. But with that, you know, surveillance and privacy and all the stuff that we're talking about, it comes with, it's maybe a little different for us than others, but we have a certain flavor to it that's important for us. So when I looked at this presentation or the title and I saw the word surveillance, I was thinking, wow, that's kind of like a four-letter word now. People think of surveillance and they think it's a dirty word. It's something nefarious that's going on, instead of a word that says, oh, I should feel comforted by it. And maybe it's the word usage, and maybe there's a better word that we could use. But you know, using surveillance in a public place hopefully makes shoppers feel more secure, right? But there is a whole privacy aspect to that. And it's not just cameras that can do surveillance, right? At this point, you can even use, you know, and it's not maybe not considered exactly surveillance, but, you know, Wi-Fi. You can use Wi-Fi to track where people are going around your center or around any kind of public space. So the idea of watching you or knowing what you're doing is kind of expanding, and you know, and that's where I think a lot of this privacy initiative and CCPA, which you know, we deal with a lot of CCPA because we have a lot of centers in California. We're based out of California, not as much on the GDPR side because we're not overseas. But that, I think, is a lot where this is coming from, is that need to protect people's rights, right, and what they can see. So from a Macerich perspective, privacy and security, and what are we doing? We want to use surveillance primarily to secure our centers. We want people to be safe. We want people to feel safe. You know, you're in a public place, you're in a mall, you don't want to have to think if something's going to go wrong. You want to hopefully trust that the center you're at is keeping you safe. So that's kind of our primary objective with any kind of surveillance or anything there. Second is we want to manage risk, right? So we want to make sure people are paying attention and not playing around, like not playing on escalators, right? We want to keep them safe from themselves in some way, but also protect ourselves from something happening to us. And then on top of that, you know, there's so many other things that you could do with data that could be considered an infringement on privacy that we want to keep, you know, privacy laws in mind and take all other solutions on a case-by-case basis. So, you know, other than securing our centers and managing risk, those are the primary two. Everything else we're looking at, we're keeping in mind, but, you know, we have to kind of take that in stride with our risk profile and things like that. So We talked a little bit about security and risk mitigation. So what else can we do? Marketing. One of the things that kind of strikes me is with marketing, there's so much that we can do in a physical world that the online world has been doing for so long, right? If you go to an online store, they know what your shopping cart has or had in it, right? They know when you've abandoned the shopping cart. They know what you've looked at. Stuff that, you know, I know that these privacy laws are hitting the online world hard, right? Because they've been collecting this data for years and doing things. And, you know, some of those bad apples have kind of ruined it for the entire organization, or the world, I should say, because they were doing things with data, selling it, doing all sorts of things to kind of, you know, make money on the data that we on the physical side haven't really gotten into. So that's the marketing aspect. We can market to them. Analytics, you know, knowing what's going on in our mall, being able to kind of put our mall in the right light is, or being able to do things to the mall that enhances the shopper experience. That is another thing that we can do, and there's more as well. But what we have to do now is weigh these things against privacy concerns and the privacy data, right? And, you know, as you can see, a lot of times now we're looking at privacy as more important, right? So security and risk, we've always kind of felt like that goes without saying. We have to do that. It's for the shopper's good. It's for the center's good. But now as we look at marketing analytics and all the other stuff that comes along with it, does that outweigh what we want to do with privacy or our concerns with our shoppers and our tenants and everybody who's in there? So, you know, privacy has really taken on more of a heavy role in this case, and it's something that we're looking at every single time now. So it's not just, oh, we want to go and start marketing to people as they walk around the mall. No, now we have that privacy kind of specters is kind of sitting over our shoulder and making sure we're doing it, and we're making sure we're doing it right. So while there's some downsides to it, there's a lot of upside to it in terms of make sure you do it right, take care of the data, don't do anything that you shouldn't be doing, and that's where we are. So where do we go from here? Where are we going? So and what advice could I give? Like determining your risk profile, that was key for us. We did that. We make sure we know how risky we want to be on privacy-related things. We continue to work with legal and privacy teams to make sure that we're adhering to what we want to do, especially on new endeavors. And we want to keep our privacy policies up to date. And that's what I tend to spend a lot of my time doing now is we get new privacy policies, got to update them on websites and Wi-Fi and all that stuff, and allowing people to opt out where they can. So that's where we're going. So with that, I'll turn it back over to Jim, and thank you for your time.
Awesome, Brian. Great job. Can you go back one screen, one slide to your scale? I think that's just a great example of striking the balance, right? All those things on the left are important, as is the privacy on the right. But what is the balance? Because if we don't get it right, we're going to miss some opportunities. And if we do it wrong, it can have very long-term negative impacts. So I think using the scale, you know, and getting that balance right is actually a very interesting way to communicate that. So thank you so much. And for we've got Brian on this call. We all shop in malls, so hopefully you're getting your questions ready and you start letting us know how you're thinking on this. And with that, I'm going to introduce our next speaker, Emmanuel Daniel from Microsoft. Emmanuel is the Director for Applied Innovation and Incubation, Smart Buildings and Campuses for Microsoft. He is knee-deep in the redesign, the rebuild of Microsoft's campus. They're going in directions that not many folks go to. They've got the experience of a real estate campus for all these years, and they've obviously got a very good understanding of technology. I met Emmanuel maybe a year or so ago, and I'm excited to have him in our community. He is smart. He is thoughtful. And him and I had some really good conversations at our Core Tech event last year about privacy. And so somebody who's right in the front of the battle and has the tools and technologies at their disposal, I'm really glad that Emmanuel has agreed to join us today. And with that, Emmanuel, I will turn it over to you.
Thank you, Jim. Good morning, everyone. My name is Emmanuel. I'm part of Microsoft's digital transformation team. And what I basically do is I work with our real estate team in defining what the digital transformation strategy should look like. So what does that mean? When we look at the digital transformation strategy for our campus, it's our big transformation is happening out of Redmond, and we call that the Redmond Campus Modernization. But in addition to that, all that we do in one campus impacts all of our campuses globally. Any service, any experience that I offer out of the U.S. must be made available to employees across any campus that I have. What you're looking at on the screen now is a rendering of what the potential new East Campus Modernization Project would look like. I just put this up there to show you the SAES, the scale, size, and scope of the activities that we're doing and how we have to design all of the experiences so that they can get replicated. And when I talk about design, it always has to be privacy by design. That's absolutely critical for us. So in terms of the scope of the present project, we're looking at 72 acres, 17 buildings, 2.5 million square feet of workspace scattered across 12,000 people. Massive. Now you take that to global projects that we have. This is just one of the many projects that fit into us. Our biggest challenge when we started this campus was how do we build the experiences across our campuses and our portfolio so people would be able to trust the experiences that we're offering, consume them, and drive productivity and impact across all the activities that they're doing. The goal for us is none of the services could be mandated, none of the services could be forced upon the people, but the services have to address a need or a requirement which allows them to be better versions of themselves. How do we do that? How do we go about defining that? And the underlying principle for us was privacy by design. Now, if you look at experiences for us on a campus, what is it? We talk about experiences all the way from getting to campus, choosing the mode of transportation that you have to take to get to the campus, coming in, arriving, getting your access. If you're driving in, parking your car, and being able to find out where you parked your car. If you're going to a different building, and on our campus out here in Redmond, there are a lot of people that go for meetings across different buildings, and not everybody knows every building on the campus. How do we help you get access seamlessly? How do we help you find a parking spot? How do we help you find a room? How do we let you know the activities happening in that building? How do we drive engagement of that physical space? In addition to that, we also focus heavily on accessibility. Okay, accessibility is non-negotiable. Okay, it must be accessible to everybody. Now, if you look at all these common tendencies across the experiences that we are defining, the key question that we get asked all the time is, how are you going to be sure people will actually use this space and drive effective utilization of the space that they're building? How are you going to be sure that the services that you are providing is not a fancy nice to have, but is a mandatory need that would solve the requirements of all the people that are coming in? And the last question of all that we get asked all the time is, why do you think people would trust an organization with the services that you're providing? Would this be another form of tracking? Would this be another form of audit? Or would people perceive it as, you know, hey, Microsoft, this is none of your business. You know, I come to you, I work, I go home. That's all you need to know. And these are the challenges that we face with when we come to privacy, in addition to legal laws that are spread across states, countries, and cities that we're working on. So for us, if I give you an example, what does this actually mean? What does it look like? The moment you start talking about data is collected no matter where you go today. You may not know it. You may know it. The key for us is to be able to identify the different types of data that is needed to be able to drive every kind of experience. What you're seeing here is an example of one specific scenario slash experience on campus that we're trying to, and we're trying to figure out, okay, what data do I actually need to make these experiences happen? And if you look at transportation, and transportation is a big deal for us because we're trying to help promote people to do ride sharing, people to use public transportation, people, if you still want to drive, you know, drive over to the campus, but, you know, to move around the campus, why don't you take a shuttle? Why don't you share that ride with your friends and colleagues? Hence, optimizing the amount of transportation travel and traffic that we have on the roads. Now, if I look at this, the options to an individual are huge. They can choose to take a shuttle, they can choose to walk, they can choose to take a bike. You know, if you have a scooter, you can probably scoot down the roads as well. In that particular case, how do I define or guide you towards the best option that is suited towards your personal profile? People like to run, people like to walk, people like to take the shuttle. How do I collaborate that or cross-reference that data with public transportation systems? I mean, if you take cities like Tokyo or like Singapore, where we have people coming to the office, a large portion of them do rely on public transportation networks. data do we share? What data do we consume? Okay, and the options goes on. So this is where the challenge comes to us to say, hey, you know, with all this data that you're collecting, how do we guarantee that privacy element with each of the users that we have that are consuming these systems? And that's why we start talking about privacy by design. Why is privacy by design important? Because data is what is driving innovation. And data privacy is what is driving trust for us. So basically, our foundation is we start with trying to understand what are the benefits to you, the user, in terms of the services that we're providing. We put you in control of each of the services. I think it's a great point on being able to opt in and giving you the option. But the choice of opting in should directly depend upon the benefit that you're going to receive as an outcome of consuming that service. If the benefit is great and it helps you drive your productivity, drive your engagement, and effectively for us, physical utilization and consumption of that space to make it more effective, people will definitely opt in. Second, transparency. At the end of the day, if people don't understand what they're getting into and the benefits associated with it, they're not going to consume it. It doesn't matter how good or enticing it is. People will eventually come up to it. Our goal as an outcome of this is to make it as simple as possible to say, if you want these services, if you want these benefits, this is what you have to expose. Again, this is what we're collecting. Now, tied down to privacy, and I think Jim did a beautiful point highlighting it earlier, is with the load coming on all the digital services, is how are we going to secure these services? And security doesn't start only at the service. It starts at the device, at the network, giving people the confidence that, yes, this is absolutely secure. There's no way the information could be misused for anything else. Complying with local legal requirements and, you know, international legal requirements. Once again, our portfolio is a global portfolio. Hence, adhering to that and giving them that confidence is important. Now, the reason I put content-based targeting is a lot of the times we will still depend on third-party content for some of the services, such as public transportation or shuttles or cabs in certain countries. How do we ensure that our employees' data is not going to be exploited or misused by people that we share this with in terms of providing an end-to-end visible service? That's what it means for us, and that's why privacy for us is absolutely non-negotiable when it comes to designing these services. With that, thank you so much, and I'm going to pass it back to you, Jim.
Emmanuel, you just left 7 minutes, so much information. Couple things. First of all, thank you in all these languages. That's wonderful. The other thing I didn't mention about Emmanuel early on is he has a very international perspective, worked in Singapore, worked in the Middle East, and so he's bringing a very international perspective to the strategy that Microsoft is deploying, which I think is wonderful. I've got like a million questions. The first one that comes to my mind, though, is for those folks who've got real estate in different parts of the world, does your privacy strategy have to be different based upon local laws or local customs? How do you deal with that international component?
So to a large extent, Jim, we try to make it universally applicable because, once again, we have to ensure every service that we offer here is available to employees in any part of the world. The difference for us comes with specific regulations such as, you know, GDPR out of Europe, all the specific regulations that are now coming out of Singapore, that are coming out of India. The way we look at it is most of our services, our experience in adhering to that, also have to take care of cultural requirements in that particular geo to be able to comply with the privacy laws. We try to go to the highest standards possible, but we also recognize that depending upon the region where we are operating, the highest standards may not be sufficient to drive that effective utilization of space, and that's where the cultural elements of what people are willing to give up starts to matter in our service design.
So it's going to be different in different parts of the world. Well, I was really glad when we chatted in November that you said, you know, this whole campus transformation that's really taking technology very serious to create these experiences, that privacy was a pillar. And so that's encouraging to see major organizations, very technically capable, big real estate project, ahead of the times. But you're really looking into this topic and giving it an awful lot of thought. So thank you for that. All right. Moving on to our next speaker, Sharara Shagagi, principal and national leader of cybersecurity for CohnReznick. I also had the opportunity to work with Sharara on this topic in November. Has such a great international perspective. Has been doing this his whole career, and within CohnReznick, he's focused on helping clients with their cybersecurity strategy and transformation programs. And by leveraging his extensive technology and risk management leadership experience, He successfully helped chief technology, risk, compliance, legal, finance, operations, and security officers achieve their goals and optimize their critical and strategic programs. He's got a very wide, broad, deep perspective on privacy, and we're really excited to have him join us. Sharia.
Before we have him join us, we'll show a quick video on ConResnick.
Perfect. Thank you.
The free-for-all era of data privacy is over. Companies that don't respect and secure the personal data they collect may lose trust and business and face substantial financial penalties for violating laws that protect data privacy. In response, businesses are racing to put processes and controls in place to meet regulatory requirements, but risk increasing vulnerability to more sophisticated cybercriminals as the digital attack surface expands. Too many organizations have yet to approach cybersecurity and privacy holistically. Policies that disclose how a customer's data is collected, shared, stored, and used must align with the processes and controls that operationalize those policies. ConResnick offers security and privacy by design, an approach tailored to your company's specific needs to safeguard assets, meet regulatory requirements, and prepare your business for a secure future.
Sharia, very well done.
Thank you, Jim. Good afternoon, good morning, everyone, and thanks for your time here. Great presentation and key messages from Brian and Emmanuel, and as it relates to convenience and efficiency versus surveillance, as it relates to specifically the real estate and the smart buildings, I'll take you through a few thoughts over the course of the next few minutes. So in general, we as a firm service a number of industries. One of our major industries is real estate. We cover tax audit advisory, and I'm responsible for the privacy and security for organizations. And I can tell you that in the past so many years doing this in this business, majority of my clients were in financial services, but in recent years, because of all the things we heard from Jim, Brian, and Emmanuel, the data is growing and it's actually going all over the map in terms of, you know, monetization and ability to really take advantage of all the data that we have to be able to, I heard Jim saying before, privacy as an amenity. That could be offered in the future, but also very important to note that privacy by design and security by design is really going to be very common set of parameters in our future any systems development life cycle. So that's really important to note. Where we are today in terms of cyber and privacy, and I'm going to focus on privacy, but the two go very well together because while privacy from a policy perspective and the policies derived from a number of drivers from regulations, government mandates, even the ethics touched on data monetization strategies of the corporations, the corporate culture. I think Emmanuel touched on even demographic or even, in my opinion, you know, X-Gen, how do they perceive privacy? You know, if you look at an interesting topic that Jim and I spoke a few months back on social scoring in China and how is that perceived by public in China versus if you take the same concept and apply it here, even within the states, we will probably get different feedback and opinion. So the net message here is privacy is not one size fit all. And to that extent, you know, we have seen some movements from a standpoint of government. If you remember, 9/11 changed our relationship with how government and in cooperation with the private sector like telecommunication can actually perform significant surveillance because of quote-unquote national security, and that we have accepted. We have accepted to go through the airports with basically, you know, understanding that we're going to have to take our shoes off or we're going to be scanned, and those are all norm to us after all these years. I think COVID-19 will push the privacy threshold further because now we are discussing, and government in cooperation again with private sector, we are discussing contact tracing, we are looking at buildings, you know, capturing your temperature. So where is all this data going? So it's going to be a lot of interesting sort of future how far this pendulum is going to go. In terms of remote workspace, constantly, day by day, you hear that because of significant shift from centralized corporate network managed environment, now even your cybersecurity policies have to be reviewed to make sure that now that you've pushed it out to endpoints, which is working from home with your own Wi-Fi, and the whole transaction processing, what does that mean and what risks are imposed, especially now heavy, significant reliance on collaboration tools such as what Jim mentioned on Zoom and others. So we're dealing with a lot of issues here right now. Number of breaches have significantly gone up in the past few weeks. The bad guys, as you know, always looking for distractions, right? So the perfect time for them. In terms of the world is not going to go back. We have billions of devices attached to internet. It's going to, you know, double or triple in the next few years because of the nature of the beast, technology transformation, IoT devices, you know, you name it. So given that, the problem is just expanding. We call it attack surface is just expanding, and that creates a whole set of challenges. And as a result of course, various data sharing and or data monetization strategies that corporations have been using or doing, especially data-rich corporations, you can see that governments are now stepping in saying enough is enough and let's start putting some responsibility in the hands of corporate responsibility in the hands of organizations that collect and share data. So that by itself is adding more to the complexity. I took this picture actually 2-3 days ago from my apartment when Comfort was docking. And as you can see from this slide, you know, we're now dealing with a whole new set of crises that will ultimately change the game in terms of privacy for us. So the new norm, if you will. And we just have to start looking at it from a standpoint of, you know, what the new world would look like. As I indicated, you really need to start looking at it from a standpoint of how you start sharing your data and collecting your data and how you're managing and protecting that data. That's why it's very important to keep privacy and security at the forefront, and as I mentioned earlier, by design, so that you are, you know, not surprised when a product or a solution is out the door and you are kind of creating a lack of balance to Brian's sort of a point about the trade-off between security and privacy. So this is really important for us to start looking at. And regulations are going to continue to increase in this space. With CCPA, actually, if you look it up, there is a significant request right now to, request to Attorney General of California, requesting for postponement of the enforcement, which is coming in July, but no response yet. So right now, everything is going to be still in effect in terms of enforcement of the compliance with the regulations as of July. But if my gut feel is that given the current environment, there may be some considerations to postpone it to next year. And then also don't forget that regardless of postponement, the private right of action which if your company gets breached, anyone in California and or as a class action lawsuit can actually file complaints based on the fact that, you know, they're subject to that right as a result of the law. So that's not postponed. That's actually in effect right now. And I'll wrap it up right now with this last slide, which is very similar to what Brian shared. It's very important, again, to be able to create that balance. And the balance is based on ability to know how to, what data you collect, which most organizations don't have a good handle of it right now. What data do you collect and how do you manage it and who do you share it with? So that's kind of what we call data mapping exercise, which is the first step in the process. And then, of course, looking at your corporate policy as it relates to privacy, which is, again, derived from ethics, regulations, government, corporate culture, your client base, all of that has to be factored in. But the most important thing here is the extended enterprise. Your company is not just working on your own within the four walls. You have to share data to fulfill a process to your extended enterprise. So that's something that is really important to be able to factor in. So with that said, I'll hand it back to Jim. Thank you, Jim.
Yeah, I mean, trying to unpack what you just said requires a lot of thought and a lot of discussion, very, very deep and very wide. Connecting a couple dots, your point cannot be overlooked that large social disruptions, especially one at the scale we're seeing right now, can potentially be used to infringe on privacy at an accelerated rate. People are scared. People will make decisions because of the current situation. So we have to understand the balance of the threat versus the benefit. And then showing how that can impact the building owner. So you've got cameras in the building. Well, the next logical step for cameras is facial recognition. Facial recognition against visual databases, facial databases, if you will, for criminals and the like. Well, in 2004, I was in the Hong Kong airport, and they were using cameras to take my temperature. As you walk through, if you had a temperature, your face was red. If your face was red, they pulled you to a room off to the side and did further testing. So that can, we can see that coming down the road. And then you take it all the way to the nth degree, where in China you saw people being pulled out of their apartments because they were known to have the coronavirus and were not self-reporting. So this is a complex conversation, and it's a complex conversation, especially for building owners, and I'm just grateful to have folks like you on the call to begin this conversation. We've actually been having this conversation for 5 years in the RealCom community, but obviously it's accelerated in the last 90 days. So, Shara, thank you for that. Really appreciate that. And with that, I'm going to introduce our next speaker, Charles Stuckey. Charles is with the Chief Marketing Officer of Join. And Charles is an early investor and advisory board member for Join with nearly 17 years of leadership at Cisco. Charles most recently led the development of automated software denied defined networking, SDN, platforms for Cisco enabling service providers and cloud companies to offer cloud-managed networking as a service enterprise. So deep, deep level of experience when it comes to technology and what it's capable of, especially as it relates to privacy. And what we're going to do is show you a video from Join right now, and then Charles will follow up. Thank you.
And Join was able to light up the Wi-Fi service in an 18-day turnaround. So we've been working successfully with Join for 2 years now, and it's been a true partnership. We have happy mutual customers that's really backed up by the customer service and the quality of the service that Join provides.
All right, well, thank you, Jim. And I'm very grateful to be here. I'm grateful to Jim and Boston Properties for the partnership. And I know that there's really two big questions on everybody's mind these days. One is, how do we get through this? And how do we recover on the other side? And I'm going to talk a little bit about both of those. Clearly, privacy is a through line on both of those topics. So we introduced Join with the video. As you know, we provide networking as a service, Class A office buildings, and we are very focused on security and performance and ease of use. And on the topic of how we can be helpful now. How do we get through this now? One thing that we are rolling out this week, free of charge, is a VPN service. So we know that large companies like Boston Properties are probably well equipped to handle a sudden increase in workers at home, but we found that many of our tenants in the buildings that we serve and many other companies may not be as prepared as the attack surface is increasing. So we spoke earlier with Jim about this, that we are making this available. If you're interested, let me know that we will provide a VPN service posted from our cloud to members of the commercial real estate community just to be of service during this crisis. I am new to join into this audience. Jim did a good job introducing me, so I won't spend much time on that. But I have seen the impact of technology, especially applied technology, over the years through multiple cycles. And we're definitely seeing a huge change in the workforce now with the demands on cybersecurity and privacy, but also all sorts of amenities and the expectation of much more turnkey services, because basically we have a digital native workforce. And clearly as we recover from this, everybody will be more steeped in how to work digitally. And I think their expectations for how their work for how their workplace will serve that will continue to rise. And so very simple message here, just like we saw with Emmanuel on a campus, a building and a building, therefore building owners and operators have a lot of services to provide to users of that building, tenants and guests. And some of those are the types of spaces that they provide, flex, retail, smart suites, existing upgrades or even common areas, but also in terms of number three on this page, the building itself will have to get a lot smarter. And one of the things to think about as we recover from this, the expectations that the building will be aware of how to modulate social distancing in different circumstances when conditions aren't in a either totally locked down or totally open as we had before, but we may have ways that we modulate entire buildings or parts of that building. And so that we know the buildings are just going to have to get smarter, and therefore all the issues that we've been talking about today on how to manage privacy will come to the fore. And the way this has been done in the past is it's a lot of silos, separate networks. Every vendor has their own security and privacy policy, and the tenants do the same thing as they come into a building. And so you can easily see that the implication is the way that most buildings are done today, the way that technology and privacy policies are set is way too uncoordinated. And it also prevents way too many attack surfaces. So there's a security problem on top of that. So we know this will have to change as we come out of this. Surely this will be one of the areas that changes. And what we've seen before is that this will have to become a core competency of IT. And like we're seeing with AI and big data, this will also require really close partnership between the business leaders and the IT leaders because of all the trade-offs and balances that we've been talking about through this seminar. But we are already talking to leaders in the industry, and they are seeing it this way, that this is a competency. And one way to think about this is we've learned lessons on security from the cloud. For example, where you have a lot of systems, one of the things you do is consolidate data away from the end user systems. That makes it easier to secure. And by consolidating, as most of us have done using cloud computing, resources into one area, you can create the resources and expertise to apply best practice. In this case, best practice on security and best practice on privacy. And the third thing we've learned talking is that even when you have a high standard, you still have to be active with your other professional peers on what is business reasonable at any point in time. And so we think this will be the sort of the framework that we use to get a professional grade of privacy management as part of the IT and application service mix. And to wrap up, I would like to introduce a polling question, which is we would love to know sort of how you see the future. So we have a polling question here that basically is asking, what do you think will look like on the other side of this? Will we see a lot of vacancy because of all the business damage? And will we see the opposite, that there'll be so much digital required in the economy that we'll see lots of new startups needing space? Do you think we'll just have a much more dramatic expectation for how the building is cleaned, how we track visitors, so for contact tracing, or how we respond to emergencies? Or maybe commercial real estate will move away from property for a while and go towards rebuilding the domestic and local supply chains and health research. Those are different scenarios we're considering. So I'm interested in your input in that. Thanks for that, and thank you for letting me speak today.
Great presentation, Charles. We're watching the poll results. It seems like that center one, tenants and their employees will expect much higher standards, is clearly out in front. And so one of the questions I had for you, given your technical background, between sensors, cameras, and audible algorithms, we can easily determine the density of a conference room. Do you think the day will come when you walk into a conference room and there's one too many person, and the algorithm says, you know, please, somebody must leave, you're not, you know, complying with our density requirements? I mean, do we get to that day?
Well, I think it would be even better if the building were aware of what was going on and didn't manage density at the last second. Imagine an elevator that says, hey, we're only allowed 4 people in today. Well, then you'll just have a crowd in the lobby. It would be better if the building had, think about Uber. It has a profile about the users that's been built up, and then based on conditions, it can communicate. Maybe the building knows that some companies and some employees have offered that they can easily switch to work from home, and on a day where density looks like it's going to be high, the building could reach out and, you know, with participation of the people, modulate the density of a building and therefore that conference room. It's much better to respond in sort of a situational awareness way, being aware of the weather and the health conditions and the expected occupancy in a building, and modulate the whole smart building as opposed to just a smart conference room. I do think we'll see that.
Let's get one more poll before we move on to Ellen. Sarah, if you could bring up the privacy as an amenity. Imagine the day when a building owner really leans into this and goes through all sorts of troubles to look at people's internet connections, maybe putting firewalls, a support team to make sure people can't get through to them. Think of a multifamily building. Make sure all the video cameras are not capturing face images for use at other places. If they put privacy as an amenity, do you think the world would be interested in that for a building owner? Interesting. So we're at 60-40. It's okay. So right now, people think, and again, this is early, right, in this conversation, but even today, some are saying that if I knew I walked into a building and it was clean and it was safe, but it also offered a higher level of privacy, that might be something I'd be interested in looking at. All right, Sarah, capture that graph. I want to remember this these results. All right, with that, I'd like to introduce our last speaker, and then we're going to get into a conversation. Great presentation so far, everybody. Really want to say thank you. Alan Tangen, Business Development Manager for Cooper Lighting Solutions. He spent over 20 years working with communication technologies, predominantly in healthcare. That's going to be good for our conversation. He's developed an expert understanding of the challenges facing healthcare and significant value technology can deliver to overcome them, and now he's going to transport that to the built environment. So with that, Alan, I'd like to say thank you for being here and looking forward to your comments. Play that video if we could, sir.
Thank you, Jim. So as Jim said, my name is Alan Tangen, and I'm the head of RTLS Business Development and Sales at Cooper Lighting Solutions. For those of you who are not familiar with Cooper, we were a part of Eaton until about a month and a half ago when we officially became a part of Signify. Together with Signify, we are the largest lighting company in the world. In addition to providing lighting technology, we are also at the forefront of many other exciting technologies. And what makes us a little different than other technology vendors is that we're able to take advantage of the lighting fixture real estate. So by integrating technology into the lighting fixtures, we can not only provide better technology, but at a fraction of the cost of legacy systems. Our purpose is to unlock the extraordinary potential of light for brighter lives and a better world. I'm sure everyone on this webinar has heard of the quote, "Big Brother is watching you." This is a quote that often comes to mind with today's technology and today's topic. Our technology today is far more advanced than what George Orwell was describing in his dystopian novel, 1984. And I think while we don't want to benchmark ourselves against 1984, it's a valid point that we don't actually live in that world, despite our technological advances. And that should, I think, solace some of those that may be concerned. Today, I'm going to be talking about RTLS, wayfinding, and some ideas on how to deal with privacy. So what is RTLS? RTLS stands for Real-Time Locating Systems, and it consists of badges and tags that are battery-powered that report location to an infrastructure. Applications make sense of that location data and solve several problems. Now, I can't get into all the use cases today, but I've selected three that I think might be of value to you. First of all, building design. Second, asset management. And third, contact tracing. So building design, and this gets into a little bit of what Jim and Charles was talking about with advancement of buildings. So through RTLS data, we can actually design more efficient buildings. The utilization data can be used to answer questions such as how big should this building be? How many rooms should it have? Do we have enough conference rooms? Should there be a bigger cafeteria? And where should these rooms be in relation to one another? Asset management. Asset management is a predominant use case for RTLS today. In knowing how many assets are in the building, where they are, and the status of those assets, you can save millions of dollars. And the final one, contact tracing. Contact tracing is the ability to know who has been in contact with whom and what. And today, obviously, that's especially relevant in dealing with infectious disease such as COVID-19. This data can save lives. Whereas RTLS uses tags to send location data to an infrastructure, wayfinding utilizes an infrastructure to send location data to mobile devices such as smartphones. And it's essentially like GPS. For indoors. So if you say you're heading to the mall, you can use your GPS and an app such as Waze to get you there. Once you're there, the wayfinding system can actually have a parking spot reserved for you and greet you when you arrive. And as you're navigating the mall, the wayfinding system will show you how to get to where you want to go. At the same time, the map may display locations of interest or send you targeted messages with things that might be of interest to you. Both of these technologies are very valuable, but they can also be abused. And so when implementing this type of technology, it's critical that you have values and norms that guide the use of these systems so that people are clear on what the systems are going to be used for, as well as how they're going to be utilized. You want all the stakeholders you want buy-in of all stakeholders. And so it's important that the stakeholders understand what the value of the system is to them, as well as being comfortable with the technology. Cybersecurity is essential, and especially when it comes to sensitive data. There are a lot of startups in this industry, and security is not always their top priority. So ideally, your system should be UL2900-1 listed, which is a UL standard for software cybersecurity for network-connected products. Sensitive data should only be accessible to those who actually need to use that data. And in many use cases, you don't need to tie an identity to a device. And maybe you should have an opt-in policy, depending on what that use case is. You also want to make sure that when you install these systems, you don't install them necessarily everywhere. So RTLS, for example, you probably don't want to put sensors in a bathroom. Then also, you want to make sure that the aesthetics are taken into account. I've been into many implementations and beautiful buildings with beautiful designs. You look up at the ceiling, and it's like a bunch of devices are staring back down at you, and that doesn't exactly put you at ease. So make sure that you consider what the environment will look like when you're done and how people might feel about that. So in conclusion, these systems can have tremendous value when used responsibly, and they can, the value can far go far beyond the detriments, and we can have a fantastic future ahead of us. Thank you.
Jim, you may be on mute.
Sorry. Brian, around, you brought up a question. What do you say to people who voice concerns about how this technology affects their privacy? Let me give you a specific. So as lighting systems advance and we put microphones in to be able to say lights on, audible commands, that obviously, and that microphone is in the light, which is on the network, that, let's say it's in a boardroom, right, where confidential conversations, how do we make sure that that conversation is kept private, given that we've now put a microphone in the middle of our boardroom?
That's a great question. I think when implementing technology, it has to be governed by the culture of the business, if it's a business, and you have to have clear norms and values around that. I think that's more crucial than ever, and people have to be aware of what's there. And like I mentioned, you have to understand what the value is as well. So it is a balancing act. But if you have the right norms and values around it, I think that's the answer.
And then to your point about, you know, you go into a building or you look up at the ceiling like Brian and I do when we go into buildings, and you see all these new devices, specifically a hotel room. Now you're seeing all sorts of things on the ceiling, and I'm pretty technical, and I look, I go, I wonder what that is. Do you think the day comes when hotels put little sheets on the counters that say, you know, because we care about your privacy, we want you to know, we go these extra steps, and just to let you know, the five things on the ceiling are doing this. Do you think that day ever comes, or is that overdoing it?
No, I think it's important to be open about it. If you're not open, then people notice things on their own, and then that's when they come up with conspiracy theories and things like that. So I think definitely you should be open. You should know what the value is, right? I mean, if you're going to the hotel room, if your app can tell you where your hotel room is, maybe you're okay with it, right? I mean, finding your hotel room or knowing where your kids are if you're in a resort somewhere. So it's a trade-off, but I think you have to be transparent about what you're doing.
Right. Well, and I think this just really brings up the point that, you know, the cyber topic, separate from the privacy topic, both have to be taken a lot more serious by the built environment. Because as has been said throughout this whole conversation, as we instrument buildings more and more, you know, to make them better, safer, more enjoyable, better experiences, we also have to realize that there's a threat on the other side of it that we have to pay a lot of attention to. So thank you for your presentation. I appreciate that. We're going to bring up a quick poll. Sarah, if you can bring it up. Recently, in all sorts of places around the world, even in Florida, spring breakers, cell phones data was tracked, and they saw what they went after. They were finally, you know, convinced to leave spring break. And then more recently, there's a website out there that can literally predict or show which states or cities are better at staying at home than others by virtue of cell phone movement or lack of it. And so the question is, do you think it's appropriate to use cell phone data to contract trace for public health? And Let's see how everybody responds. And I'd maybe let the panel weigh in. Brian, I mean, let's go down the line. Do you guys, how do you feel about this particular use of data?
You know, I think it's a, I would be okay with it. I'm probably, I don't know if I'm in the minority here, but, you know, I like the use of data for public use and, you know, my personal opinion, you know, and when you say, you know, hey, you know, you got Alexa in the house, right? I like being able to talk to Alexa. So I like the idea of using data to kind of help the public, to help myself, right, to make things more efficient for me. But I really have to trust that the companies that are getting that data are going to use it responsibly. And I think that's where I go back and forth on it. But I think right. So.
That, great point. Yes, but I need to know who's grabbing the data, what are their policies, what are their protocols, and is it stay there? To Shargar's illustration, you know, that data, you know, once she said yes to that form, that data was sent to a million places. Emmanuel, what do you think about this use of cell data to contract trace for public health?
So it is critical, you know. I think the trade-off is, Would you like to be healthy and safe, and are you willing to give up that data? I think it is important, but like the previous comment, the guarantee that this data will be used specifically for public health, and this data will not be misused, or this data will not be used to make decisions that are against the person providing it. Those are the concerns. If we can allay to rest, this probably should be made available.
Right. Well, the next logical question is, now that we knew those people were in Florida and spring break, and then they went back to these other areas that could create hotspots, does that show any liability on their standpoint because they did not listen to the, wasn't a mandated, it was a suggested, you know, is there any liability with them if they did in fact catch it in Miami at spring break, take it back to Chicago? These are all the, you know, unintended consequences and complex questions that I think we're all going to have to address in the next couple of years. Shariar, an opinion on this one?
Yeah, I mean, if you asked me this question a year ago, I would say no. But I think, as we discussed, when you talk about privacy, it's all in the context of various parameters. And in this case, it's for public health. And, you know, if we know that doing this will save lives, the answer is no-brainer, yes. At the same time, we heard from Emmanuel and Brian about, you know, the whole value chain and making sure that everybody is tracked in terms of, you know, responsibility. But my answer would be yes in this environment.
And Charles?
Yeah, I was on the, I think, same page as Emmanuel, which is, and we can do this technically. You remember when we weren't sure if we could use credit cards on the internet, those of us old enough to remember that debate. And what we did was we set new standards for responsibility. And I think the same thing is going to have to come with data. We need data to keep ourselves safe. But those who have the data have to be held to a high standard of custody of that data, anonymizing and de-identifying it are some of the key technologies that are going with it. But we've had a laissez-faire attitude, sort of, once you have someone's data, too bad for whomever you got it from. You know, you have it, now you can use it however you want. That clearly has to change.
All right. Alan, wrap up on that poll. What do you think?
Sure. So I think if people are knowingly potentially exposing themselves to something in this environment, then they should be held accountable for that.
Yeah, I mean, this has the potential of redefining democracy. I mean, not to get too big or too esoteric, but this, and it's especially ironic and appropriate given the fact that we're all quasi-quarantined in our homes because of a pandemic. And to Shariar's earlier point, you know, large disruptive events continue to nip at privacy, as 9/11 did at this will. And I think it's going to require a healthy debate. Let's get very focused on building owners. Did the day come when building owners use their cameras to look at temperatures on faces and either allow or restrict access into a building based on that data. And then second question is that information sent to the local healthcare provider and the local police department? So, Brian, we'll start with you. Will we ever see cameras that can detect temperature in malls?
Cameras that can detect temperatures in malls, what you said?
Temperature, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I saw it literally 8 years ago, or actually 2004 in Hong Kong. They were, as we came through the gate, there were cameras that took our read of our face for temperature, and then if you were excel at a certain higher level, they'd pull you aside and question you.
Yeah, so that's a good question. I don't, you know, again, if you asked me like probably a year ago, I'd say, no, I don't think temperature is going to be one of the things we're going to really be gauging for. But now as things have changed in the past, you know, 3 months or even 3 weeks, it might be something that's out there. You know, if it provides a service to the public in which people feel safer, I think you'll see kind of a little bit of a groundswell around it. But, you know, that might also be a huge privacy concern in terms of, you know, hey, now my, you know, I may have an elevated, just normal walking around, my temperature might be elevated enough to trigger these all the time. And now you're kind of dipping into my personal medical history just so I can be in your public space. So, you know, it might be out there. I don't know if it's going to take hold here necessarily like it is in Hong Kong. That's kind of my think, at least in like the mall sectors is kind of where I'm thinking. But
yeah. Well, and that was in 2004. So that was 16 years ago, right? I mean, and wow. So interesting that we're seeing this topic come up again because of Corona, that technology exists. Emmanuel, have any thought or consideration of temperature readers in the new Microsoft campus?
So there is discussion around it, but the biggest factor for us is if you look at health and well-being of the employee and to make the workspaces and the surrounding spaces safe, it is important. But at the same time, how would people react to having camera-type devices in workspaces? Would that set off with the form factor, with the aesthetics of that device, create a perception that they're being spied on, that they're being tracked? So those are the issues that we're dealing with. But taking it another perspective, we've been looking at it from an angle of indoor air quality. How do we guarantee better quality of the environment inside the building that will help mitigate potential health risks that come out? And if health scanners have to be one of them, how do we put that in a non-intrusive way so employees or people that visit our buildings don't feel threatened? Those are perspectives that we're taking, but you know, these are very tough decisions to make and to deploy.
Shariar, you want to weigh in?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at it from a standpoint of, you know, temperature data, and the technology is obviously evolving, and to, you know, it's obvious that today we have the building management systems, all the IoTs, all the sensors, it's very doable. So from a technology perspective, it's doable. The question is, you know, if temperature data is tagged to an individual and that considered to be PHI, you know, the health information, personal health information, and according to CCPA, is that a personal info that is subject to certain regulations? And then, you know, what's the role of the government and what's the role of the, you know, private sector? I think that's why I advise one of my daughters to go to study privacy law, because I think this will be subject to a lot of interesting and complicated scenarios as it relates to legality as well as responsibility and, you know, for the greater cause.
Well, if we look at history, that one gentleman with the shoe bomb changed the protocol at every one of our airports to the point where we had to take off our shoes. And the question is, with this, and especially all the conversation with how this virus spread and proximity, think about an airplane, right? You're crunched in with people with an air system that may or may not meet, you know, biological standards of coronavirus. Does it now become, when as we're going through the gate, we not only get checked for, you know, potential weapons or, you know, some type of destructive device, are we also now going to be screened for health? You know, I mean, in order to get on that airplane, are you going to have a certain temperature or some other body measurement? And I know it seems crazy right now, but 6 months from now, at the rate everything's changing, we may see. And I'd be real curious to see if airlines are already having those discussions.
Yeah, and you said some countries are already doing that anyway. So.
Yeah, well, yeah, like I said, it's been done in Hong Kong since 2004. And I don't know if that was correlated with the SARS epidemic, or I'd have to go back and connect some dates. But, yeah, they were using it a long time ago. Charles, Alan, either one want to weigh in on the idea of, you know, requiring temperature reads before you get into a building?
Yeah. Yeah, two things, Charles, here. For sure, you already saw in China that individuals carrying around on their iPhone basically a real-time status of here's how healthy I am. And your question is, could that be updated as you go through spaces? So you go through an airport, you go into a building, it takes your temperature, and it updates that hopefully green square that you're holding up that indicates your health. And one interesting question would be, would people want that? Would people actually say, I want to know how I'm doing? And a little bit, as we've seen with the newer generation, they're much more open on social media. Will people say, hey, I want the environment to help me track how I'm doing? And so I don't mind that it updates in real time. And I think the answer may be partially in how severe the reaction is. If, as I said earlier, we only have two states, either yes or no, you can or you can't fly. But what if there's in-between states, which is, oh, you can fly, but we want you to wear a mask, or we need you to use hand sanitizer and not order any food. I'm making stuff up. But are there states in between that we could modulate how we handle different states of health? Then people might be more interested in having the environment help them track their own state.
Well, I mean, take it to the building level. I mean, with technology where it's at, you could put some type of heat sensor in a cell phone that says, as I hold my cell phone, it's going to take X number of medical data points, which basically, if you're inclined to use a cell phone and walk around and you're holding it, they could be getting real-time medical data. That's not technically that difficult to do, I don't believe.
Especially if it's a watch.
Alan, say it's a watch. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, yeah.
I think whenever you implement. Sorry, there's a delay.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
I think anytime you implement technology, it needs to be for the greater good, and it needs to be, you know, obviously it needs to have a purpose, and I could see the purpose of monitoring temperatures in the building of individuals. You don't necessarily have to tie that data to that individual. So letting somebody know that, hey, you know, you have a temperature, I'm okay with it as long as there's strict guidelines around it. I mean, when you start recording that data and then tracing you know, for years about your health history, that's a completely different thing, right?
So we saw, as somebody mentioned early on, that China has instituted a program where you're a yellow, green, or red. Let's do a quick poll question, Sarah. Question would be, would you be open to having a code on your phone that tells the general public or facilities that you are healthy, yes or no? And that's I think, step one. But I think with technology is the pace at which it's developing, I think that's just the start point. I think somebody mentioned in the question and answer, an Apple Watch with sensors or some type of medical watch. I mean, I think it could be done instantaneously. And then the question becomes, is that voluntary opt-in or is it required? So would you be open to having a health code on your phone? So I think we're seeing a little bit of the cultural differences, 65-35, so still a little bit, three-quarters, two-thirds of the folks are saying no, and one-third is saying I'd be fine with it. So even within our own community, our own country, as somebody said, state to state, city to city, and Shargar, I think you were very smart to have your daughter go into privacy law, because I don't think this is going away. So what I'd like to do now is start left to right. Brian, we've got about 10 minutes left. If you could just give us a suggestion, advice, some insight, Monday morning kind of advice as to if you're a building owner, operator, if you're a tenant, as this relates to the built environment, What advice do you give somebody? So, you know, on that Monday morning conference call, you start thinking about the way we behave in a building as it relates to privacy.
So, I touched on it in my presentation a little bit, is just doing the due diligence ahead of time. I mean, here's the one thing that I know we're struggling with a little bit, is we see CCPA is a little bit of a moving target, or at least it has been. We're trying to get to that moving, you know, we're trying to hit that target while it's moving so that we can be ready when it was implemented on January 1st. And as it still has some changes going on to it and people aren't sure how to do it, it's been real challenging there. So I think just getting the tenets of what you're trying to accomplish down first. I mean, we know that we're going to have to establish what kind of risk profile are we going to want to have? How much data are we as a company going to want to gather and keep for our business purposes, to make our business better, to service our customers better? So kind of getting that down and understanding what we want to accomplish. And then from there, we can kind of follow the laws in terms of how we treat that data as we get it, right? But to understand what data we want, to understand how we want to get it, to understand what the privacy implications are on that, and getting a base foundation there allows us to, I think, would allow us to more easily hit that moving target as it moves, because we know what we want to do. Now we just got to follow that target when it moves.
Okay, very good. Emmanuel.
Thanks, Jim. From my perspective, I think the most important thing is when I have my facilities up and running, how do I create an environment of trust so people that come into my facilities would know that the facilities have been designed with their best interests at heart, that they would know that, you know, I'm not going to misuse that data, I'm not going to create an atmosphere of fear or concern or segregation surrounding it. How do I deliver that message, right? So even though, to I think Ryan's earlier point, when someone walks in and looks up at the ceiling, I look up at the ceiling. It's just the fear and perception that is there going to be abuse or misuse of the information that is being collected, and who that beneficiary is. So for me, conveying that message of trust, giving them the surety that the environment in that building, the space in that building, the layout of that building has been designed to benefit you, and whatever data we collect and harness is for the best interest of everyone that uses that space, would be my primary objective.
Good. Very good. Sharia?
Yeah. So if you look at today, most organizations historically have looked at privacy from a legal compliance point of view. As a matter of fact, most of privacy organizations are still reporting up to those functions. But as you evolve, privacy is really now changed in terms of corporate strategy. How is it tied to that? What products and services, and who's your customer base, and, you know, from a trust management perspective and differentiating factors. So I think the companies need to look at privacy from a, you know, 360-degree view with all the things that we've discussed on this call today, and be able to really come up with the right privacy strategy, which is then driving policies and practices ultimately with enabling technology.
Perfect. Charles? You may be on mute.
Thank you. Yeah, for sure, these big events cause change, societal change and technology change, and this certainly is the biggest of my lifetime on the scale of World War II, as best I can tell. But when you have these changes, new awareness, new competencies, new accountabilities tend to come along as part of what builds up the foundation for new technology and new services. So I think this being so sensitive, health data being so sensitive, but still so important to both our health and to how our work lives will evolve and our buildings, that I think there will be new awareness, competency, and accountability, and we'll build on that. So I'm optimistic that we will figure out how to incorporate this into making our lives better.
Alan?
Yeah, so I think we're definitely at a cusp of another technological revolution. And
I think you have to be careful as to when you're implementing technology, don't implement it, don't let the technology drive your business. Let your business drive your use of technology. So don't measure technology by whether the technology was implemented smoothly and on time. Now, what are you looking to get out of the technology? Use it as a tool. And then again, to Manuel's point, you need to have trust around this. Without trust, this isn't going to work. So that's definitely going to be more and more important, having those values and norms and a strong culture with psychological safety.
Awesome. I just sent a poll in to Sarah. One more poll for the audience. So we've been thinking about this in the small community for the last couple of years. Given that we are going to take the next 3, 5, 7, 10 years, whatever, to debate this topic of experience and safety and efficiency against privacy, we're going to spend a lot of time, conversations, debate. People are going to think differently. Cities are going to think differently. States, the country. Do you think that the time that we take to debate this will allow other countries who don't really care about privacy to develop technology at a faster pace? Let's see what the audience says, and I'd love to get one final comment from all of you on this. Sarah's just finishing typing it up, so let's give her a second. Okay, so do you think with the time we take to debate privacy, will other countries develop new tech faster? Okay, it's about 85-15. While we're waiting for these poll results, real quick, yes or no answer. Brian, what do you think?
Absolutely. I think when we put our focus, whether it's our country or other countries, when we put our focus on things, that tech comes fast. But I absolutely think so.
Emmanuel?
Yeah, absolutely, Jim. And, you know, an example of this is, if you look at Singapore today, the contact tracing app that the government has rolled out to track the people that have come into contact and the adoption of 1 million people consuming it is basically evidence of that.
Yep. Shire?
Yes, for sure. And perfect example is social scoring that's going on in China.
We may have a whole other webinar on what's going on over there, just because a lot of folks are not aware as much as folks like people on this panel. But yeah, I agree with you 100%. Charles?
Yes, I do. But I want to point out that technology spreads really quickly. So if we're behind, we can figure out our own innovations very quickly on top of what they've done.
Great point. Alan? I think you may be on mute.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I think any time that you don't have regulation, you're going to be able to develop things faster. So absolutely.
Okay. Well, gentlemen, I just want to say a huge thank you. Complex topic, one that's going to, I believe, accelerate under the circumstances and all the craziness going on. I really appreciate you taking the time to be with us today. I get a sense this is not going to be the last time we shall meet at our conference, which was scheduled for June but is now postponed until September. We won't just have a session on privacy this year. I believe we will have a track, and we will hopefully be reaching out to all of you. And I would encourage the audience to give a lot of thought to what was said today. You had an exceptional group of domain experts. Send the recording of this to other people. The more we need to have a lot of conversation and debate on this. So I would encourage everybody to send this out to other folks, encourage people in your company to listen to it. And so by the time we get together, God willing, in September, we will be able to take this conversation to the next level. So with that, I'm going to turn it back to Sarah. And again, thank you all participants, attendees, and have a great and safe day.
Thank you very much, Jim, and thanks also from me to all the panelists for your excellent contributions to this today's topic. I would like to invite you to join us for our next webinar that is coming up next week, Thursday. We actually implemented a coronavirus webinar series where we have four different parts, and next week is part four. So I would encourage you to register for that event. If you have missed the first three parts, no worries, this is not a continuous series, but we will, or the recordings for those other series are available online. And then if you have missed webinars in the past or would like to sign up for future webinars but are not able to join the live events, we also make our webinars available as an audio recording. So you can subscribe here and download episodes. So thanks again to all of you for joining us today. I know everyone is super busy with other things, so I really appreciate you taking time to join us for this very important conversation.